This is the All Saints Today podcast, and I'm your host, Pastor Wilbur Allen III. And I am so happy to have two guests, Dr. Jay Case. He's a professor of history at Malone University, as well as Miss Michaela Askew. She's a student. She's a senior at Malone as well, and her major is political science and psychology. Thank both of you for being on our podcast today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
I must say, I ran across an article in the Canton Repository by Sherita Gaucher regarding Voices from Southeast Canton, a Historical Look. It was a very interesting article. There was some good information in there. And so I reached out to Dr. Case. I said, this would be a great podcast to discuss this historic project. So the Voices from Southeast Canton, a Historical Look. Dr. Case, if you could tell me a little bit about what is this project?
Well, after talking with Andrea Ramsey, who was our multicultural director at Malone, got the idea of connecting with some other Black leaders in the community that are trying to preserve some of the history of Blacks in Canton, and particularly Southeast Canton. And I have a class, it's a senior seminar class, and part of what we do in this class every fall is we do some group research, some original research project. And so I had 14 students in the class, and we also like it to be a service to the community. So after talking to Andrea, and then she connected me with Lydia Lee, who's been working on a lot of the history in Lafayette Street and so forth, we thought what we'd like to do is take some oral histories of people who lived in Southeast Canton before the overpass came through, before Route 30 came through, before a lot of that neighborhood was torn out for the factories, and just record their memories and their thoughts. Oral history, and then preserve it. And the plan is, and we're moving forward on this, and I think this may happen, the McKinley Museum might be able to preserve them. So it's a more of a project of just trying to preserve the voices. And of course, you know, a lot of people are getting on in age, and so we want to be able to do that. You know, Lydia Lee mentioned that some people have already passed on, which would have been, you know, great to hear from. So what we want to hear from is, you know, some people and get their voice recorded for the future.
So basically the inspiration for this project was based upon a conversation you had with Andrea Ramsey.
Yeah, that's what started it all. And then I talked to a few other people to try to figure out exactly maybe what the best way to proceed and what, given the time we had in the class and the nature of, you know, what I'm, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing with the students, what would be the kind of project that best served everybody. And so that's where we went.
So how long was the duration of the research project?
Well, it was a semester. So it was the fall semester, because mm-hmm. that's when the class meets. And we do a number of other things in the class. So I kind of had to divide time between the other things we do in the class and then the research project. So we're getting students together and give them background on Canton. We took them on a little field trip, drove down to Southeast Canton. Stopped and got out down there by where the old Timken building was and showed that part, then, you know, drove under 30 and went up to Sherrick Road and drove around there, and then went over to the primary school there just west of there. And then got to meet a number of people. We brought some people in to talk to the students and then kind of set up interviews and recording to record the oral histories of a number of people. We hoped to have gotten more, but we sort of ran out of time. It was hard to get everything set up and arranged, as it, you know, at least not as many as what I had hoped for, given the time constraints we had.
So I gather, like, Michaela was involved in the interviewing process, correct?
That's right. She did a great job.
Michaela, what was some of the, out of those interviews with the folks who lived in the Southeast Quadrant, what was some of the information you were able to glean from them? What were some of the stories like?
Okay, so I'll start with, I interviewed with another fellow student. I interviewed Miss Patty Williams, and then what we did with the interviews after we did them, we transcribed them. So I did the interview with Patty, and then I transcribed a separate interview with Ernie Andrews and Marie DeBose. So I kind of got to be a part of two, in the sense of I was involved in one and then I got to listen to another one. But my interview with Patty, it was like a wonderful experience. She's such a wonderful lady, and she was so attentive with her answers, and you could just tell that as she started to talk about the Southeast Canton neighborhood, how highly she felt about that experience of living there. It was just very heartwarming, because the way that she talked about it, she told us so many different things about her family and her neighbors, and just interacting with all the people that owned the businesses and went to the churches in that neighborhood. So from talking to her, it was just very much, we got to understand how community oriented and how community based the neighborhood was, and how they all looked out for each other, and they were all invested in the well-being and just caring about each one of the people that lived in their neighborhood. So that was some of the, like, the feelings that I got. And then we learned a lot about business owners, in the sense of there were so many businesses there, and that there was a lively church community, and that everybody was involved in each other's lives, whether it was your neighbors or somebody who lived across town. Like, everybody knew everybody, and that is still the case today, in the sense of in the interviews that I transcribed with Ernie and Marie. Marie actually told Ernie at one point, she was like, it's so lovely to meet you, because she had heard so many stories about him just from growing up in that neighborhood and going to church there. She had never met him before that interview, but she told him, like, it was an honor to meet him, and that she'd heard he was wonderful at playing the organ in church. So that was just a testament right there to how much everyone in the community knew each other and cared about each other and was invested in the same things.
I remember reading, they were saying that, I guess the project actually displaced, I think it was like 300 churches, businesses, and homes over a major portion of the Southeast section of Canton. And that really is an entire community that was displaced. Yeah. And yes.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, I think it was maybe 1,500 people overall. So and when you use that word community, right? I mean, it's a number of things, right? It's not just homes, it's businesses, but it's not just businesses, it's churches, right? And it's other community sort of organizations, but then also the ties that people had, those things that are valuable but are not material, you know, that got broken up also. So I you know, those are things that make up a community, and that's part of what was sad about the whole transformation.
From what I, growing up, some of the stories I even heard was told, did you run across the type of businesses that were down here at this time in Southeast Canton?
Yeah, Michaela, do you want to speak on that? Or do you want me to speak on that?
You can speak on that. That's okay. Fine. I'll
yeah,
let
that's
you
fine.
Talk about
you know,
it.
What we relied, you know, one of the great sort of jewels that Canton has is Sherita Gauche, you know, and the work she does with the repository and sort of things. So, you know, I mean, she's been doing historical work just through her newspaper work. And so we had a great source in her article on the businesses along Cherry Street. And that was a great starting point, you know, to talk about the, I mean, she mentioned, you know, a lot of the stores and the barbershop, and the funeral parlors, and then also some of the nightclubs and things like that. And those things came out in the oral histories too, as part of the important sort of, oh, just the, well, you know, elements of the community. That were there, you know, before all the transformation took place. And so it was great to have that background from Sherita Gauche, so we knew what to expect and build upon when the students were interviewing the people.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something to that?
Sure.
I just wanted to say a couple things that we learned, like more personal things, sorry, from the interviews. Miss Patty had said that she actually modeled one of her businesses based upon just learning and understanding in that neighborhood that you could be a business owner if it was something that you put your mind to. So she was learning from all the businesses that were in that neighborhood. And then also, like, we learned an interesting tidbit that we had mentioned when we did our presentation that actually, like, if you used to go into the grocery stores, they would let you put your groceries on a tab, almost like you were allowed to just get whatever you needed, and then you could come back and pay on your tab whenever you were able to. So that was just something that, you know, went into us, like, understanding just how much of a community the neighborhood was based upon. And then also, like, just something that we couldn't even fathom nowadays being the case. Like, I could never imagine going into, like, Walmart or Giant Eagle or something and then being like, oh, yep, just put it on my tab. Like, that's very interesting.
I remember hearing other stories about Southeast Canton. As you say, it was had a strong sense of community, and crime really wasn't an issue. Of course, there's the misperception that there is crime in the Southeast End. Now, by trade, I'm an accountant as well, and I have an opportunity at my job to interact with police officers. I work at the Kent Civic Center, and so I usually take the opportunity to, you know, to talk to them and get a feel for the city. And from what they tell me now is, crime isn't just located just in the Southeast section, that is pretty much spread throughout the city. And I like what Michaela was saying about there was a strong sense of community. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, the question I have now is, what lessons can we learn? Because I remember when I was in seminary, I discovered through study that these types of urban renewal projects were initiated across the country in a lot of the major urban areas, and how communities were even decimated. I remember reading where the individuals who even sold their homes, they did not receive the full value of their homes. So in essence, generational wealth was negated. Or eliminated. Yes. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes. And actually, Miss Patty in our interview mentioned that specifically, what you had said about people not receiving the full value for their homes or their businesses or whatever was, you know, I would say taken from them when they decided that that's where they were going to put the bridge. she said that it left a lot of people forced into government housing and never to be able to own a home again because they were never given the full value of the things that they should have been. So I learned that, like, just from her, in the sense of, like, it was actually, like, it actually happened to real people. Her family, her mom, her grandma, all of her neighbors, like, it was a very real thing that happened to all of those people.
And then, of course, as we know, I'm sorry, yes, Dr. Case.
Oh, I was going to say, and I was learning a number of things through this project also, not only in talking to people from Canton, but in sort of doing background information and reading, for instance. A lot of this pattern came out of what was going on in New York City, which had started in some ways even before World War II in the 20s and 30s, but then really kicked in the 40s and 50s under a famous city planner, Robert Moses. And this is what a lot of scholars have found, and it's true, New York City and so many other cities and communities across the country where this urban renewal comes in. It's usually, almost always, it is the low-income people who are displaced. And, of course, they have the least amount of power. And, you know, they have voices, but the voices are often not heard. And they have the fewest resources to kind of resist. And then a lot of people just don't understand or know that that has gone on. But and what we're also learning about crime is that community ties are such an important part of lowering crime. And so, you know, you have that or making sure crime doesn't rise in the first place. And so you had that in the Southeast Canton before all of this took place. And then you're disrupting and breaking up that community. You know, with people being displaced and all those community what some social scientists would call social capital that had been built up over time gets broken down. And, you know, it happened in Canton, but it happened in a large scale in New York City and many other places. I'm familiar with Chicago. I used to live near Gary, Indiana. It's just the same story in many, many places.
Yeah. I just wanted to add two more quick things. When I was interviewing Miss Patty, she actually mentioned something that I think, like, goes along with exactly what we're saying, is, like, when you lose those community ties, it is easier for crime and other nefarious things to happen because your neighbors don't really know you anymore and everything gets broken up, because she had mentioned several times, even at our presentation, she had mentioned that, like, she knew not to, quote unquote, act up because everybody would be telling her mom, or her mom would find out by the time she got home, because everybody knew who she was and knew who her mom was. And she knew that if she was acting necessarily bad or out of order, that it would get back to her mom and she would be in trouble later at home. And then the other thing I wanted to know is when Dr. Case brought up, but Robert Moses, actually the Canton City Council people, they actually sent their plan over to Robert Moses for him to review, and they got information back from him. So that was his plans in New York were sort of implemented here in Canton as well. Like, we modeled it after that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different levels in terms of decimating or eliminating a community like this. And as we know, in terms of home ownership, the first step of generational wealth is home ownership. And so, just as Michaela was stating, so these families that did accumulate equity, they end up taking steps backward. Then, of course, as you know, that affects the following generations.
Right.
Because the family lost that equity, that generational wealth. Here's a question I have is, so Has there been any other lessons learned from this in terms of the powers that be, in terms of urban renewal, understanding the negative impact of urban renewal?
Whew. That's a good question. I think some people have learned lessons and some people have not. I think, this is not my area of expertise if we're talking about, if we're talking about, you know, exactly how things work in Canton, but also across the nation. But just my, you know, my observation is that it's a mixed bag in terms of what lessons have been learned. I do know that, for instance, in New York City, there's much, much greater awareness. Robert Moses was sort of he was almost a celebrity in the 1950s. I mean, you know, he was building the you know, bridges and highways and, you know, the Rockefeller Center and just all sorts of big, bold, the World Shea Stadium and the World's Fairgrounds and all these big flashy sort of things that people could look at and see, wow, that is great. And what you missed were he displaced 500,000 people over the years in New York City. 500,000 people were forced out of their homes. And at the time, that was largely unknown. And of course, as I mentioned, they were lower income people who, you know, people could more easily ignore. And at the time, most people in New York City and elsewhere, they just saw the big flashy things that Robert Moses did. But what has happened since then is that there's been a real reevaluation of Robert Moses. And that's been helpful because in many other cities across the country, there's been a reevaluation of that approach. And so there are people who've learned that lesson, but I can also tell you there's a lot of people that don't understand this or just don't know, just don't know what happens in these sort of situations, and they get misperceptions about urban areas, and you know, as they the word that has been used for the decades, slums, or you know, that is that sort of stereotype they have of a lot of low income areas.
That's a very good point. When I was a seminary student in Pittsburgh, ran across a PBS special called Wiley Avenue Days. And it's almost, it parallels what happened here in Canton, New York, even New Orleans, other cities. Mm-hmm. In Pittsburgh, there was the Hill District. And then there was the Lower Hill District. And it had a storied history like Cherry Avenue has here. And then urban renewal came through and they wiped out the Lower Hill District. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're familiar with Pittsburgh, they built a civic arena there.
Okay, yeah.
But Wiley Avenue would take you all the way down into downtown Pittsburgh. And as I watched the special, it was obvious that there was that displacement of businesses. As a matter of fact, the Negro League team, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, the owner of the team, had a club there called Crawford Bar and Grill, a well-known spot. And so that history was lost as well. Here's a critical question, I think, which is applicable today, urban renewal and the effects of it. Do you believe that it is a precursor to 21st century gentrification? Because that's the concern I have now. Yeah. Areas like Southeast Canton that have had this experience, this negative impact, it seemingly makes it an easy target for gentrification. Is it a precursor?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. I wouldn't call myself an expert on this, but the little that I know, you know, I think it in many places like New York City was a precursor to gentrification. You get, you know, when you displace people, that not only bumps them out of their neighborhood, but they have to move to other newer other neighborhoods where it drives down housing prices, and there's real difficulty. And then with increased interest in moving back into the city for new people, that makes those places prime targets for people to come in and buy up cheap housing and bring in higher income people to fix it up, which of course further displaces the low income people that are here. And that, so for instance, in New York City, I think of on the Upper West Side, that is something that took place, Upper West Side of Manhattan, I should say, but also areas of like Brooklyn and the Bedford-Stuyvesant areas that has happened. Now that's New York City, where there's a great deal of desire by higher income people to move back into the city and take advantage of city life. I don't know how that would play out in a place like Canton. In Midwest Rust Belt cities, there hasn't been as much interest with upper or middle class people moving back into the city. But, you know, there's, you know, in Southeast Canton, what you did, I don't know about gentrification in terms of people moving in. And whether that will ever happen and move in and buy up the housing. But what you did have was corporations moving in. And here's the problem with the way urban renewal worked in the 1950s. Up to that point, right, the United States had kind of a history of eminent domain, where the government could claim land and buy land for government public projects, a highway to go through, a bridge, a government building. But there was a shift in the 50s where not only could the government buy those lands under eminent domain, but then they could sell them to corporations. Right. And so it's no longer used for government work. It's now government working hand in hand with corporations to get land that corporations are very interested in. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that Robert Moses was doing in New York City quite a bit. And that happened in Canton. Right. That is the whole Lafayette Street, the Madison Lathrop area that was, you know, cleared out and then sold to Hercules and Detroit Diesel and, you know, Timken. And so, you know, those are corporations that benefited from that. So it wasn't quite the same as upper or middle class people moving in with housing, but it was moving out these people so that, you know, that and you know, the argument is, well, it helps the economy. But I don't know. I don't know exactly what the studies are, whether there's a cost there that a lot of people don't recognize, even if it does help the economy. And I don't know what the studies are about how much that really does help the economy. But it's a question on policy. Is it a good idea to bring in private individuals or corporations to be, you know, people who receive land claimed under eminent domain? That's a question about, you know, how good of a policy that really is.
That's a very, I'm sorry.
Oh,
yes, please.
Oh, sorry. No, I just wanted to say that, of course, if Dr. Case isn't an expert, I'm definitely not. But I just wanted to say that I thought that the themes are similar. Like, he was pointing at, like, the themes of both are similar. And I think so because it showed, like, lawmakers or policy implementers that they could take advantage of the lower income neighborhoods without any real consequences or pushback. And that's essentially the thing. As Dr. Case said, it wasn't really people moving in. It was just implementing things that would make life easier for certain groups of people without considering what it would be like for the groups of people that were actually having their communities and their livelihoods upended.
That's a great point. That's a great point, Michaela. Yeah. Yeah. The themes are similar there. Yeah.
I know one critical concern right now is here in the United States, they're saying there's a housing deficit, a housing deficit of about 3.2 million homes or houses. And of course, the Wall Street Journal has placed Canton number three on as an emerging housing market. And one of the driving forces behind that is that Canton is affordable. So when you couple those two together, areas like Southeast Canton would be prime in terms of an affordable city. And then you have this housing deficit nationally. And so that's a concern that I have regarding this urban renewal, gentrification.
And certainly, you know, you want to try to figure out how do you build up the economy of a place like Canton? I think that's a very important question for the community. And, you know, Rust Belt cities in particular do not have not in the last couple of decades had the draw that other sort of cities, you know, on the East Coast, the West Coast, for instance, have. But you have to do it in a way, you have to look at, you know, the question of who's going to be more deeply affected by this and how do you handle this in a way that does not further disrupt communities or put low-income people at a great disadvantage while still providing, you know, opportunity. And I you know, and I'm not an expert on that. I don't know how to do that well. I'm a historian. I'll wait till it's all done and look back 50 years later and say, well, this is what I see, you know, happened back then.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on our podcast. And this was most informative. And I just will add that with this whole urban renewal piece, obviously there was a moral lapse as to what happened back in the 1950s and 60s here in Canton, as well as other cities across the country. We're getting ready to close. Dr. Case, you have any final remarks?
Yeah. But just on that last point, I think it was a moral lapse. But one of the other problems is that a lot of people did not have the correct perception of what was going on. A lot of people in power had that information available to them, but it took a long time to figure out exactly. You know, Robert Moses, he just lied about what he was doing, and a lot of people believed him. And they didn't have a lot of information to really understand what was really going on there. And so the other problem is not that goes along with sort of the moral issues is how do we see clearly? How do we get a good understanding of what is really going on? And how do we help others see clearly? That's a tricky human nature question too. So yeah, that's a little thought I had about that.
That's a very good point. Michaela, any final remarks?
I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed doing this project, and at our presentation for it, we talked, all of us students in the class talked about it, but it was so interesting to learn all the things that I didn't know about Canton, but as well as urban renewal, like across the country, and just understanding that. And this is something that I think Dr. Case was getting at. He said some people have realized it, but not everyone has. And I think it's important that it's a lesson that we can all learn is, excuse me, when things like this happen and policymakers start trying to do things that they think will improve and they're taking advantage of neighborhoods and whatnot, it's like we have to be able to understand and help the people that are going to be displaced because it's going to impact them a lot. And we have to do more to give back to the communities that we might be taking from. So I just wanted to say that. And then just the project overall was just so cool to be a part of, and getting to talk with all of the people at the presentation, as well as Ms. Patty in my interview. It was just a wonderful experience. So
that's a wonderful point, Michaela. We really met so many wonderful people through this. It was really a blessing to us in the whole process as well.
Well, let us pray that moving forward in terms of any community or municipal reorganization, that compassion would definitely be present, and so that we can maintain that sense of community. Thank you both for coming on this podcast. And I just want to say to you folks, please share this podcast with others so that we can learn from history. And I'm sure Dr. Case is a strong proponent that there are lessons to be learned from history. So please feel free to go to allsaintstemple.org. We have podcasts and other things that will help you with your walk with the Lord. Blessings to you.